This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 22nd of April 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tom Edwards, and Clemency Burton-Hill.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, a welcome shot in the arm or Millie playing to the gallery. We'll pick apart the new US aid package for Syria and explore what its impact is likely to be on the ground.
We'll also look ahead to this week's episode of The Culture Show, where Robert Bound will be talking nonsense, in a manner of speaking, with celebrated poet Murray Lachlan Young.
Nonsense poetry gives you this kind of completely out there ability to pull any words together and just see what they sound like.
And in the new issue of Monocle, which hits newsstands this week, Anastasia Maloney heads to Medellin in Colombia to talk urban planning and much more. We'll hear why it's been named the world's most innovative city.
You see these patches of huge investment in the slums, in the hillside slums of Medellin. And lots of Latin American cities are trying to copy this example. So there's lots of things, tangible things that you can see that people say has improved the lives of about 3 million people in Medellin.
And of course, we'll be setting the agenda for the day with our Asia editor-at-large, for whom South Korean-Japanese relations and man's ongoing battle with computers are subjects on the menu.
All that, plus we spin some great music too. All to come in the next hour right here on Midori House.
Plenty to look forward to then in the next 60 minutes. Before we get started, let's get the latest news headlines from around the world with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. Federal prosecutors in the United States have been preparing criminal charges against an ethnic Chechen suspected in the deadly Boston Marathon bombings. The man, 19-year-old Zhokhar Tsarnaev, is severely wounded and unable to speak 3 days after his capture. However, two American news networks are reporting that Tsarnaev has regained consciousness and is responding in writing to questions put to him by authorities. Boston residents and visitors gathered for a time of prayer and reflection on Sunday as the community continued to support each other through the aftermath of the marathon bombings. Volunteers from the American Red Cross, including Jay Bonifie, offered material goods and counsel as if anyone wanted to share their grief.
It's going to take a while for everyone to be able to get back to normal life. Some people have told us that they've been here almost every day since the bombings. Others have, are really dealing with this very well. So it's going to take a while for everyone to get back to normalcy and to feel right. And we're going to be here to support that community throughout that time.
Opposition activists in Syria say forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad have killed at least 85 people after storming a Damascus suburb on Sunday. The action comes after 5 days of fighting. The Human Rights Watch organization says authorities in Burma's Rakhine State aided the ethnic cleansing of Rohingya Muslims last year in crimes against humanity that have sparked anti-Muslim violence elsewhere in the country. The group says security forces were complicit in disarming Rohingya Muslims of makeshift weapons and standing by or even joining in as Rakhine Buddhist mobs killed men, women and children in June and October 2012. The re-election of Italy's president has raised the prospect of an end to 2 months of political stalemate. Correspondents say a broad agreement between traditional political groups on the left and right to re-elect the 87-year-old Giorgio Napolitano has handed him the leverage to pressure opposing parties to form a government or face a snap election. African finance ministers meeting in Washington have told their rich nation counterparts to work harder and faster to kick-start their economies and avoid a prolonged slump. Nigerian finance minister Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala said there was concern that slow growth in the eurozone, which provides a large market for many African countries and is coupled with a slowdown in emerging economies, would make them more vulnerable. Despite a global economic slowdown in 2012, most African economies grew at close to 6%. Buoyed by strong internal demand and higher commodity prices. Malaysia's forthcoming election is already being touted as one of the country's closest campaigns and a major test for Prime Minister Najib Razak's ruling coalition. Najib's Barisan National Party, Barisan Nasional, has been in power since independence 56 years ago, but the opposition has been gaining ground on a pledge to end corruption. With at least 2.6 million first-time voters expected to cast their ballots, most of them young voters in the early 20s to mid-30s, it's not surprising, according to correspondents, that politicians from the ruling coalition and opposition parties have been wooing them. James Chin of Monash University in Malaysia said it might be that only a total change of government would be required by young voters.
For most of these young voters, they have a very different set of values compared to the older voters or the voters in the rural areas. Things that are important to them are things like transparency, good governance, corruption issues. So all these issues tend to look very badly for the ruling government. As you know, the Barisan Nasional, the ruling party, has been in power since independence. So for many of these young voters, what they want to see is a total change. They believe that in order to bring Malaysian democracy to the next level, you need a total change of government.
And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, James Luckhurst. It is 5 minutes past the hour. This is Midori House.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London. The time now is 10:06 in Istanbul, 8:06 here in London, and that means it's 16:06 in Tokyo.
And it is to Tokyo that we fly now as we get the show underway with our daily agenda. Three stories you need to know about for the next 24 hours. Setting today's agenda is Monocle's Asia Editor-at-Large, Kenji Hall. A very good afternoon to you, Kenji. What's the news in Tokyo today?
So I've got three items for you today. The first one I'm going to talk about is the Shogi Masters versus machines. Five professional shogi players have lost over the past few days to computer programs. This is a pretty stunning defeat for these masters of what's known as Japanese chess. Shogi is it's a lot like chess, but it has 20 pieces that are shaped like pentagons on a board with 81 squares instead of, you know, the 16 squares. 16 pieces on 64 squares in chess. The score, the final score, was machines 3, humans 1, and 1 draw. You know, this has been a long-running thing. There's been a fascination with measuring how advanced machines are by using these sort of strategic games over the years. And in the case of chess, at least, they've also become extremely valuable as a training tool for professionals.
I was going to ask you, Kenji, about this because I always think back in terms of chess, when, you know, that these noted scalps, when the machine was first capable of beating, you know, one of the grandmasters. I think when Deep Blue scored that big success, and now it's kind of acknowledged that, you know, the very best machines will always better the very best master. Is it a different kind of dynamic in Japan? Was there a lot of pride amongst the shogi playing community that, you know, no machine would ever consistently manage to defeat our very best players?
Interestingly enough, this is actually the first time we've seen this sort of this type of matchup between active professional shogi players and machines. This time around, there were five different computer programs. All had won top places at last year's World Computer Shogi Championship. As you mentioned, there is a good degree of pride about, you know, humans beating machines. And there hasn't been as much sort of publicity as there was with IBM's Deep Blue, as you mentioned, particularly the 1996 and 1997 matches between Deep Blue and Garry Kasparov, who was the reigning world champion chess player at the time. You know, these things, and in this case, what we saw were virtual servers helping out the computer programs. They weren't as powerful as IBM's computer, which is also an interesting development because you would think that they would have put all of their kind of ammunition to bear on this, but for some reason they hadn't.
So is there a sort of sense of crushing disillusionment and despair amongst the shogi community? Do you think people will be striving to beat the computer next time around, or are people just accepting that this is, as Tom says, now just the way it's going to be?
Well, I think it's people are accepting the fact that the computers will win from time to time. One of the shogi masters His name was Muda. He actually released a comment, Hiroyuki Muda, when he lost to a program called GPS Shogi, developed at the University of Tokyo. He later apologized for his failure to, quote unquote, fulfill his duty to win. So, you know, there is a sense that of disappointment at having lost.
I mean, I can barely click open my email without something going wrong. So, frankly, that these people can take on the computer in any way is an extraordinary achievement. Shall we move on to a diplomatic crisis potentially between South Korea and Japan over a visit to a particular shrine? Tell us more.
Absolutely. So, South Korea's foreign minister Yoon Byung-se has actually canceled his trip to Japan after Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe made an offering to a Tokyo war shrine. This is according to South Korea's Yonhap news agency. We haven't actually seen confirmation from the foreign ministry in South Korea yet. Japanese authorities are also saying that they are planning to go ahead with the trip, with the hosting of the foreign minister. But it looks likely that that foreign minister Yoon will not be coming. This Shinto shrine, Yasukuni, has been a symbol of Japan's militarism that dates back to the early 20th century. From time to time, these sorts of things happen when officials pay visits to the shrine. So this is kind of a long-running saga.
Kenji, tell us exactly how difficult a balancing act is this in Japan, because there's obviously a great expectation to sort of honour the war dead. It's a necessary part of, leading a state is to commemorate, your nation's victims, however those losses were suffered. Obviously, then, there are these delicate diplomatic issues to consider as well. How much of an ongoing calculation? Is this something that's always a problem for the Japanese Prime Minister?
Always a problem. Over the years, we've seen prime ministers say they will go, they won't go.
He didn't actually go to the shrine, though. Can we just clarify that? He didn't actually visit the shrine.
That's right. Prime Minister Abe did not actually visit the shrine. And he's actually said that he has no plans to do so as not to anger China and South Korea. What he did do was he made a ritual offering of a pine tree, what's known as masakaki. These are decorated wooden sticks, which are supposed to hold the donor's wishes. Just the fact that he was paying homage to the shrine, I think, was enough for both Beijing and Seoul to get angry. China's People's Daily newspaper, which is the mouthpiece of the ruling Communist Party, also criticized Abe's offering to the shrine. So we've seen reaction from both South Korea and China.
Do we know what would have been on the agenda were the meeting to have gone ahead?
Well, they were supposed to talk about bilateral relations, and this is one of the things that the South Korean side has, or at least officials have said privately to Yonhap News Agency. They've said that the offering by Abe makes it difficult to hold a productive discussion about bilateral relations. Often we see this whole sort of back and forth. Japan says it's already made amends for its brutal colonization of the Asian region, but then other countries in Asia, they want a full apology, they want compensation, and their anger flares up whenever there's an official who visits the shrine or who talks of whitewashing Japanese history textbooks. So this is likely to continue.
Kenji, let's just talk very briefly about a story out of China. We've talked before about soaring property prices, in particular how it's affecting the city of Shanghai, but I gather, not really property, but soaring prices of a different kind. Tell us about this one. It's a slightly kind of macabre story almost.
Absolutely. Chinese residents in Shanghai are now worried over soaring prices of burial sites. According to the South China Morning Post, a tomb site of less than 1 square meter in Shanghai now costs the equivalent of 6,000 euros. And that's more than double the cost per square meter that you would pay for a home in the city. This is a big deal. There are mounting concerns over whether the government actually can do something about this. A lot of senior citizens who are preparing themselves for their own proper burials are worried.
What options are available to them if they can't afford such a plot?
Well, it's a good question. At this point, you've seen people snapping up plots as quickly as they can. Just looking back a couple of years, since 2010, the average price of a grave in Shanghai has gone up by more than 50%. Officials have actually sort of helped to fuel some of these concerns. They've suggested that residents try other things, such as burials at sea or these multi-story columbariums. These are buildings that hold urns. But in fact, that's had the opposite effect. Just out of curiosity, I did a quick check about, you know, what it's like in Tokyo. A lot of these mega cities in Asia have similar problems. You know, where do you bury the dead? Where do you put the trash? So in Tokyo, the average cost of being buried is about 3.15 million yen, which is 24,000 euros. So it looks like Shanghai isn't quite there.
It's an expensive business, though, dying. Kenji Hall, our Asia editor-at-large, many thanks. Coming up, John Kerry doubles non-lethal aid to the Syrian opposition. We'll ask what difference this will actually make.
Culture on Monocle 24 is untouchable. Go on, just try and do it. Try and grab a handful of the top-grade cultural radio that we're dishing out and see if you can touch it. Well, exactly. Luckily, though, you can feel it. Feel the passion of the unusually button-bright presentation.
It's a fantastic contrast, and it's one of those ones that ask you to look at the brushwork, to look just at the canvas.
Feel the craftsmanship in the breathtaking live Midori House sessions.
You know, I consider myself an entertainer, so I'm really about communication. I'm not really about expressing myself so much as trying to communicate with people and bring them to tears or bring them to laughter or what have you.
Feel the lovingly hand-stitched production, and most of all, feel the love of art.
It's there, and it's true, but it's really only a small part of his work.
Feel the love of fiction, feel the love of film, feel the love of music, feel the love, generally.
It is the most extraordinary collation of works that you would never normally see together.
Why not invite me round? Culture with Robert Bound is a well-behaved house guest and a joy to entertain.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Whether you're in the midst of a busy business day in Europe or eating your cereal on the East Coast, The Briefing sets you up with a fast-paced mix of news and views that you won't find anywhere else.
It's a very beautiful phone, I think. It's not out till next month. That's the only phone outside of HTC at this moment.
This one I'm holding?
Yes.
No wonder we've got security.
We'll bring you the latest developments in aviation, technology, defense, retail, and media with our industry experts, a rundown of the US and Latin American papers, plus a sharp business review of the day.
It really came about with us saying, you know, this would make sense to do something that we would enjoy shopping at and kind of change the retail landscape a little bit.
So tune in to The Briefing, every day at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. At a meeting of the Syrian opposition and chief international supporters in Istanbul yesterday, US Secretary of State John Kerry was fervent in his commitment, his recommitment, as he put it, to Syrian opposition forces, pledging another $123 million, which brings the US aid total to $250 million. Kerry stopped short of offering arms to the Syrian opposition, but has agreed to provide so-called non-lethal support in the likely form of body armour and armoured vehicles, night vision goggles and comms equipment, as well as around $25 million worth of food aid.
Describing the current situation as a critical moment for the country, Kerry also urged the international community to make similar pledges of assistance with a target goal of reaching $1 billion in aid. To talk us through the impact of this latest aid package, we're joined by William Morris, Secretary General of the Next Century Foundation, a conflict resolution think tank with a focus on the Middle East. William, thanks very much for joining us. I guess that's the starting point. To look at this in the big picture terms, is this really going to make a significant difference? And if so, what will that be?
Well, a lot of the stuff that the West talks about is all mouth and no trousers. Of course, we had in Kuwait at the beginning of this year, in January, there was a donors conference at which the West pledged $1.5 billion in aid. This was supposed to be humanitarian aid. Virtually nothing, virtually zero of that aid has got to the Syrian refugees. Many of the women in the camps, or at least some allegedly, are turning to prostitution. They're in penury, they're in misery, living in gross conditions. The refugees topped a million from out, that's external refugees, externally displaced. Of course, the UN doesn't refer to internally displaced refugees as refugees. They call them IDPs internally. But there are at least over 2 million internally displaced people. So a lot of this stuff is all talk. But nonetheless, when it comes to military aid, the West and Qatar, particularly, and Saudi Arabia to some degree, are manning up and providing weapons. This is more weapons to throw petrol onto the fire of the Syrian civil war, and I'm not sure how helpful it'll be.
Can you clarify that, though? Because this is supposedly non-lethal aid that's
What's
going
What's non-lethal
to,
about
what does
this?
That mean?
Yeah, it's a ridiculous statement. I mean, if you're providing night vision goggles and body armor and armored cars, and meanwhile Qatar are providing... flooding the place with weapons. I mean, this is none of this is non-lethal aid. You look at, and you can buy, you know how vast the numbers of weapons being flooded into the region are. We've now had the Mali insurgency from the Libyan civil war. You can buy a Kalashnikov in the back streets in Baghdad for $18 these days. I mean, it is ridiculous, the flood of weapons into the region.
William, let's talk a little bit then about the rhetoric and maybe some of the personalities involved from the US standpoint. It's quite interesting, isn't it, to see or assess the difference that the shift has made from Hillary Clinton to John Kerry. What are your impressions of how Kerry is dealing with this? Do you think it spells a different maybe strategy from the US?
Yeah, very different. Hillary Clinton was, I think, a bit on the back foot over Syria. She didn't do that much, and on her watch, Britain had much more of a lead, along with Europe. Unfortunate, really, because Britain wasted a lot of time spending a lot of effort on uniting the Syrian opposition, and that meant uniting them under an Islamist lead, which wasn't very constructive because it gives the minorities little ownership of the future in Syria, and they end up having to resort to standing by Bashar al-Assad. Now, with this present lead from Kerry, Kerry's been, once he began to take his get his chance to take command, he has been a little more sensible. He's consulting the Russians. They are quietly having a lot of dialogue between Russia and Syria and Iran. And Russia and Iran have come on board to the idea of Bashar al-Assad going privately. They say this not publicly, but privately it is being said by senior Russians, senior Iranians, but not swiftly. They want a gradual exchange of power. They're frightened that there should be any form of Salafist leadership emerging in Syria. And on the ground, of course, the insurgency is being led by some Salafist groups like, Jabhat al-Nusra. So it's a problem.
Any chance of a negotiated settlement?
Well, every chance, but it means really that Russia has to put more pressure on Bashar al-Assad. A negotiated settlement means Bashar goes. Some of the opposition, certainly the Islamist opposition, are saying that that's a precondition, that they won't negotiate before Bashar al-Assad goes. That's difficult, really, I think. But we need to, whatever, in whatever shape or form, he has to go. And there is a lot of effort going on to promote a negotiated solution. If that can be done, and if the minorities can be given some ownership of the future, then you'll have something. At the moment, with Syria's moving towards partition, with a lot of the Christians fleeing to Latakia, a lot of the Alawites fleeing up north, and we're getting a situation, the Kurdish regions are already virtually partitioned. So we have a major problem as things stand.
William, I just wondered, it's interesting talking about, you know, the US sort of lobbying Russia, Iran, getting a bit more dialogue, if not officially. When all of this weaponry and technology comes into the country, it's distributed around. There's a lot of concern about, you know, who may follow Assad or take over, who's going to be the drivers behind that. What actually happens on the ground with all of this kit? I mean, is anyone able to really chart who has what? Is there any sense that West can actually, you know, maintain any kind of control over who has what weaponry, which of these groups, many of them very disparate, have which kind of, what kind of firepower? Is there any way anyone can actually control that?
No, not really. There was, in the early days, there were the Free Syrian Army, which was the lead force, if you like. Now that's the Islamist groups, particularly Jabhat al-Nusra, in the forefront, but other Islamist groups as well have tended to take control. The Free Syrian Army was never a unified force anyway. Areas of the, if you like to call them liberated areas of Aleppo, are mostly Islamist controlled. Now, you may not mind that. They need their day, and they've been downtrodden for years, the Sunni Arab Syrians. But on the other hand, if you want an end to this civil war, it would be better if it weren't so sectarian. The Christians, as I say, and the Alawites. The Christians are about 2 million, 10% of the population. The Alawites, arguably as many as 15 million. Their numbers are always underestimated, but the whole coastal area is Alawite. These people have no ownership of the future. And meanwhile, they see Islamist groups leading the revolution, and they are. They're getting all the arms. It's clearly the case.
William Morris, we'll have to leave it there. Fascinating to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us. Secretary General of the Next Century Foundation think tank. This is Midori House. We're off to Warsaw next.
Van uit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du var Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, dette Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards and Clemency Burton-Hill. The time is 9:26 in Warsaw, which is where we head now for a roundup of the headlines on the ground there.
With our correspondent Gulliver Cragg. Good morning, Gulliver. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning.
Great to have you with us. Let's start, shall we, with the commemoration of the 70th anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. A very emotional and charged conversation topic, I'm sure, in Poland at the moment. Tell us more about how this anniversary is being marked.
Well, the Polish authorities have really decided to go big, as it were, on celebrating this anniversary. It's a 10-year anniversary, and I suppose one thing is that they're perhaps thinking that this is the last 10-year anniversary where there might be any survivors or any people who actually fought in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising present. In fact, only one of the commanders of the ZOB, the Jewish Combat Organization, was able to make it. It's thought there are three who are still alive, but only Simcha Rotem was in good enough health to make it, and he was absolutely the star of the show at the commemoration ceremony that they had in front of the Ghetto Heroes monument in the center of Warsaw on Friday. He stepped up to the podium, and I could see that he had several pages of speech, and he went on for a very, very long time, very, very solemnly, but almost all of it was extremely moving and sort of humbling. He, apart from thanking the Polish authorities for having such a big commemoration and also having words honoring the people that he fought with, the Jews that died in the Holocaust across Poland and across Europe, and very much he was very, very keen to honor and to thank the Poles who helped Jews during the Ghetto Uprising and during the Second World War generally. But he also had strong words against all of those who did not help with the Ghetto Uprising and who denounced Jews and turned them into the Nazis. He said, I don't understand those people and I don't want to understand them. And he also said he actually ended on rather a low note, saying that he didn't really feel that the world had learned its lessons since the Holocaust, and he still felt generally worried. But he said, what can we do except keep repeating that human life is sacred and no more war, and perhaps one day humanity will listen. That ceremony actually was part of a huge program of cultural and educational activities that they've got going on throughout the whole month that the uprising lasted.
We'll watch that very carefully, Gulliver. It's fascinating stuff. Quite a very highly charged issue, as you say there. Let's talk about a charged issue of a different sort. A good sort of traditional political story, and kind of slightly bizarre. This is the end of the Treasury Minister, who I guess you could rather say maybe made the rod for his own back.
Yes, Mikołaj Budzianowski has been dismissed by the Prime Minister, Donald Tusk. This is because of what the Prime Minister kindly described as a communication problem. The Treasury Minister is responsible for Poland's main gas company, PGNiG, and PGNiG signed a memorandum of understanding with a memorandum of understanding, that's what you call it, isn't it? A memorandum of understanding with Gazprom, the Russian gas giant, to apparently build a pipeline that would go from Belarus to Slovakia, thereby transporting Russian gas without it having to pass through Ukraine. And as you know, Russia's gas-related conflicts with Ukraine are a constant political issue, and Poland is rather on the side of Ukraine in all of this. So the idea that Poland would help the Russians build a gas pipeline that would bypass Ukraine would be a very big geopolitical incident. But apparently Mikołaj Budzanowski didn't even know that this company for which he is responsible for had signed this memorandum of understanding. As a result, the Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, didn't know either. So it was a huge national embarrassment. And it comes also after Budzanowski has also been strongly criticized for the failings of the LOT Polish Airlines, which is another company which is failing and which he is somewhat responsible for. So the Polish government gets such a good press in recent years about being so well organized and managing its economy and things like that so much better than other European countries. But this episode has shown that they're not above the odd huge blunder either.
You may say, Gulliver, that it would bring shame on the country's democracy. Certainly that's the charge being laid by another politician about a hotel in Warsaw. Tell us more.
Yes, well, it's Janusz Palikot, who is famous for saying controversial things that will get him headlines. And the latest thing he's came up with is saying, we need to close down the hotel that MPs who aren't from Warsaw stay in when the parliament is sitting, because it's just a drinking den. He said that although since tabloid journalists started coming into the parliament itself, people don't drink so much in the cafeteria, but they're all drinking too much in the hotel that's nearby. Though it seems that this was really just another side of Janusz Palikot's constant strategy of thinking that any publicity is good publicity, and that whatever gets him in the papers will be a good thing, because most people, MPs who've been interviewed about this, have said this is something that was maybe true a few years ago, and now fewer and fewer MPs stay in that hotel anyway. But it is quite interesting that he has this strategy of just simply saying things that will grab headlines and get people saying, no, that's not true. And this has led Janusz Palikot to really rise in Polish politics. He now heads a party that has 40 seats in parliament, and all by kind of courting this kind of controversy. A lot of people say that they hate him, but I think that he's becoming the kind of person that they love to hate.
Gulliver, our man in Warsaw, Gulliver Cragg, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much for your time this morning. In the next half hour on the programme, we're exploring the urban regeneration typifying Medellin's landscape, and we'll be delving into the world of poetry, nonsense poetry that is, with Murray Lachlan Young.
Nonsense poetry gives you this kind of completely out there ability to pull any words together and just see what they sound like.
And we'll be leafing through the Canadian front pages with our managing editor, David Michon. Before all that, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news headlines.
Federal prosecutors in the United States have been preparing criminal charges against an ethnic Chechen suspected in the deadly Boston Marathon bombings. The man, 19-year-old Jokhar Tsarnaev, is severely wounded and unable to speak 3 days after his dramatic capture. Opposition activists in Syria say forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad have killed at least 85 people after storming a Damascus suburb on Sunday. The action comes after 5 days of fighting. The Human Rights Watch organisation says authorities in Burma's Rakhine State added the ethnic cleansing of Rohingya Muslims last year. They aided the ethnic cleansing of Rohingya Muslims last year in crimes against humanity that have sparked anti-Muslim violence elsewhere in the country. The group says security forces were complicit in disarming Rohingya Muslims of makeshift weapons and standing by or even joining in as Rakhine Buddhist mobs killed men, women and children in June and October of 2012. And the re-election of Italy's president has raised the prospect of an end to the 2 months of political stalemate. Correspondents say a broad agreement between traditional political groups on the left and right to re-elect the 87-year-old Giorgio Napolitano has handed him the leverage to pressure opposing parties to form a government or face a snap election. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Clemency Burton-Hill, and Tom Edwards. For our culture preview this week, we're going to deviate into the weird and wonderful world of nonsense poetry with poet Murray Lachlan Young.
He's preparing for the Hendrix Carnival of Knowledge in Brighton next month. In this snippet, he speaks to Rob Bound about nonsense and even performs one of his own poems about a famous rapper.
Well, it's interesting because I was just thinking about the reinvention of nonsense. And before I came on, I mean, I guess you could say it goes all the way back to Anglo-Saxon times. I don't know.
That's because no one can understand it. It just is literally nonsense.
In translation, yeah. Maybe it's more to do with the translation. Yeah, yeah. But so they had the period when they were writing Lewis Carroll, and we all know Alice in Wonderland or Alice Through the Looking Glass. That is kind of crazy.
Yeah, and, but is that nonsense or is it?
Opium-based. People say there's a potentially a lot of drug-based issues going on around nonsense poetry. And then the revival, of course, came with the psychedelic movement in the 60s and 70s. So John Lennon was a nonsense writer. And then if you look at Yellow Submarine, completely nonsense. And that was all around psychedelic drugs. So I don't know, are we waiting for the right drug?
So we're always waiting for the right drug.
I'm
welcome
not taking
to Monocle
it.
24, where we're always waiting for the drug.
Maybe the right drug is the fact that people aren't, that taking drugs isn't really cool anymore. The brain is the drug of choice, I think.
Yeah.
If it's pulling words together. And the exciting thing about nonsense poetry is that you're just allowed to pull words together. So I think for poetry or for any sort of production of words, essentially all you're doing is joining words together. And nonsense poetry gives you this kind of completely out there ability to pull any words together and just see what they sound like.
And I like the way that it's about the sound of things. So obviously you've worked on lots of different things. Performance poetry, spoken word performance is obviously being your thing, famously your thing. Is that about sense or is that about sound? Where do you start off from?
Well, I like a lot of sound stuff and alliteration. And what's the other one?
Onomatopoeia.
That's it.
Assonance, dissonance.
Assonance, that's the one I was looking for, yes, assonance. Somebody told me the difference between that and alliteration the other day. I felt very silly, but... rhythm is what is my thing.
And yeah, exactly.
And I was brought up on nonsense poets and children's poets and Dr. Seuss and Hilaire Belloc and all that sort of stuff. And the rhythm to me is hugely important and I love the voice as an instrument.
Can you give our listeners an example of something that has a very rhythmic quality? Something that not they can
mine.
Sure. Not that they can click their fingers to, but they can swoon along to.
Maybe. Yeah. So I've got a poem about P. Diddy. He came to a nightclub in London, and he had a huge entourage with him. And in the entourage, he had two guys who were specifically tasked to spray his own brand perfume every 10 minutes in the room. He also had his drinks brand with him, and they all came in, completely overtook this place, and filled it full of the eau de Diddy. And the idea is that this is the poem, which I wasn't there, but if I was there, maybe this is what I would have written. So it's called, I can't remember what it's called actually, but it goes.
Eau de Diddy is a great name for it.
Eau de Diddy, let's call it Eau de Diddy. Okay, Eau de Diddy. The vibe was contagious, his entrance outrageous. To breathe in the air became disadvantageous. So with the tss, tss, tss of his special fragrance, sprayed by his very special fragrance sprayer, into the room busted Sean Diddy Combs onto Raj, very large for a bling bling player. A bling bling player, yeah, yeah, a bling bling player, and all the ladies went crazy with the boom, 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 a boom, boom, with the boom, 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 a boom, boom, and the fellas, they put their hands up with a zoom, 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 a zoom, zoom, with the zoom, 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 a zoom, zoom, and did he give a little love? Did he? And did he bust a little move? Did he? And did he give a little love? And did he bust a little move? And did he drink a little vodka in a did a little bootin' with a tss 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 and the sub bass boom? Did the room smell the plume of the diddy diddy comb? Diddy diddy comb. Yeah, yeah. Diddy diddy comb. A diddy diddy comb with a boomalaka boomalaka boom 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 with the boomalaka boomalaka boom boom boom. And somebody shouted out, oh, no way, man. Like, this shit is obscene. And somebody else shouted out, chillax, blood. It's just like a middle-aged brother, man. Like giving it a big one, living out the dream. And with the DJ gagging because the smell was so strong, somebody shouted out, hey, Diddy, you're the Diddy man. that the ditty was gone to who knows where, but I guess it was a place containing crystal champagne, hot booty, and bass. Bitches in the living room getting it on. I ain't going home till 6 in the morning, cause that's what happened when you walk in the room. That's what happened when you're busted by the plume, and that's what happened when you're drenched in the fume. When you're drenched in the fume of the ditty ditty comb with the ditty ditty comb. Yeah, yeah. Ditty ditty comb with the a diddy diddy coon with the boom a lack a boom a lack a boom 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 with the boom a lack a boom a lack a boom 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 with a tss a tss a boom boom.
Hard to know how to follow that, really, isn't it?
I'm seldom rendered speechless, but I think Murray Lachlan Young's done it. Wow, that was Murray Lachlan Young speaking to our own Robert Bound for
speaking,
Culture.
Speaking with Rob.
Well, I don't know. Riffing? I don't know what that was. It was pretty amazing. If you want to hear more about that, you can tune in tonight. Culture Show, 1900 hours, London time, on Monocle 24.
Meanwhile, you're listening to Midori House. We'll be back with reports from the forefront of urban planning in Colombia's Medellin. Stay with us. This is Midori House. The time is 8:40 here in London, 2:40 in Bogota. All this week, we're featuring some of the stories that grace the pages of the new edition of Monocle magazine, which hits the shelves of your local bookstore of note very soon.
Medellin, once most noted for its high homicide rate and for being the hometown of infamous drug cartel boss Pablo Escobar, features in our affairs section for, thankfully, rather more positive reasons. Named this year the world's most innovative city by the Urban Land Institute, Medellin is now renowned for its urban regeneration programs and transport initiatives that have transformed both its landscape and its quality of life. Our woman in Colombia, Anastasia Maloney, caught up with Jorge Perez, Medellin's urban planning director, to find out exactly how they've done it.
This city became an unviable city, and also because of narcotraffic and Pablo Escobar, which converted Medellin in the most violent city maybe in the history of human civilization. So the problem is actually very, very complex. And what happened in Medellin is because of this deep crisis, our city learned how to build up a dialogue and a pact, a social, collective, and deep pact for the future. I strongly believe that all the good things that has succeeded in the recent years started in this process of dialogue, because without that, maybe our society would have not been able to solve the problem. One of the main things about that is to recover the city for the citizens and to build up the city as a way of living together, and to find through public space, public buildings, and working about education and cultural development has been a very powerful tool to transform our conflicts into our agreements. So I strongly believe that now we have a more viable and integrated society through that actions. And also because we've been working since our crisis in the 90s, trying to transform a city of war, a city of violence, a city of inequity and segregation into a city of integration, of equity, and as our mayor calls, a city for life. So our proposal is to use urban space, public spaces, and the whole urban infrastructure as a tool to create a community which lives integrated and in a peaceful manners. The most exciting projects besides these, I strongly believe one of the most important projects is the general park of the river. We are planning to have a very important project which deals with more than 20 kilometers along all the city for a metropolitan regional park along the river, which is a proposal to integrate both borders from west and east side of the river, and to recover the river as a natural quality of the city, because now the city is segregated for the water from the water, and the waterfronts are mainly infrastructure places, both highways and train railways. So our proposal is to generate a new attitude from the city to the river, but also new spaces, and using the highways through tunnels below the land.
That was Jorge Perez, Medellín's urban planning director, speaking to Anastasia, who also spoke to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco about her first impression of the city.
It doesn't relate to perhaps the stereotype image that most people have of Medellín. Even if you've never been to Colombia, most people around the world know that Medellín was once the most dangerous place in the world. It was far deadlier than any war zone. And Medellín's famous because in the 1980s and early 1990s, it was home to the most powerful drug cartel in the world, run by Pablo Escobar. And so when you go to Medellin now, 20 years later, after Escobar was killed, you find a very different Medellin, a Medellin that's thriving. It's got lots of urban renewal, renovation projects going on. It's a city that's forward-looking. And it really is, in Latin America, considered a leader in urban renovation, particularly in the slum and the poor areas. And so I think most visitors first coming into Medellin will be struck by a very organized, pleasant city to live in, rather than perhaps the image that they have of Medellin in their mind.
Let's go through some of these urban renewal projects. I know they're going to do a big waterfront makeover, correct?
Yes, there's a river that runs from almost the whole of Medellin through the valley. And they're trying to make that a nice waterfront area where people can jog and cycle, and there'll be cafes along the river. So they're trying to make it a focal point for citizens to relax and hang out. So that's one of the main projects. But urban renewal has been going on for the last sort of 12 years, and I think one of the reasons why it's been so successful in Medellin is because three consecutive mayors have had the same vision. And what it involves is really injecting a lot of cash and political will into the slum areas. And what's special about Medellin is that you don't see in other Latin American cities, is that they decided we're going to deal with the slums. We're not going to ignore them. We're not going to try to take them away. We're going to actually deal with what we have. And what they do is they try and put social investment in an integral way. So they'll build a library next to a nursery, next to a school, next to a health clinic, and the roads and the pavements around it will be improved. And you see these patches of huge investment in the slums, in the hillside slums of Medellin. And lots of Latin American cities are trying to copy this example. You also got great infrastructure projects like the cable car, like a bit like you see in ski resorts, that takes people from Medellin up into the hilltop slums. So there's lots of things, tangible things that you can see that people say has improved the lives of about 3 million people in Medellin.
And as you mentioned in your feature, I mean, I know the situation improved quite a lot, but how would you improve even more Medellin?
Yes, the point is that you can't deny that there has been huge amounts of social investment and that the security situation has improved considerably since the 1990s, and the murder rate is far, far lower than it ever was. However, there's still a culture of violence and gang culture that still exists in Medellin, and it's very difficult to shrug off that legacy that Pablo Escobar left behind. And so what you still find is that people without jobs, particularly young men aged between 15 and 25, who don't have any jobs, who live in the slum areas, for them still the way out is to be a gang member, to be involved with drug dealing. And that's very difficult to change. And I think part of the challenge is you can see the urban transformation, but I think it's a sort of a cultural transformation that Medellin still struggles with. And I spoke to a rapper from one of the slum areas, and he explained that very eloquently, that still the man that people look up to is the man with the gun who holds the respect in the local area, and that's still got to change.
And finally, Anastasia, I just would like to ask, how Medellin compared to Bogota, for example?
Well, I've been living in Bogota for the last 10 years, and if I had a choice, I would definitely live in Medellin. Medellin is just a much more manageable, pleasant city to live. It's got this perfect climate. It's a spring-like climate all year round. It's much easier to get around the city. There's less traffic. Medellin has a metro system, whereas Bogota doesn't. And it just seems to be more efficient. And all the public officials you speak to seem to be on the same page. They have a clear idea about the vision and the priorities of the city and the plans and what they're trying to do. And any public official you speak to is always going after the same thing, to improve the lives of the citizens and make the city more livable. Whereas if you speak to public officials in Bogota, some will tell you that, but basically it doesn't seem to be so coherent, their plan for the future of the city. Whereas in Medellin, they really do seem to know what they want.
Anastasia Maloney talking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco there. And you can read more about Medellin's transformation in the May issue of Monocle magazine, which hits newsstands and bookstores this week.
Coming up next, we'll be joined in the studio by Monocle's David Michon. I'm very excited about that, Clemency.
I can't wait. I mean, it's like I've barely been able to contain my excitement.
It's pretty exciting. He'll be reviewing the Canadian front pages. But let's get some music from that great nation first. It's Nelly Furtado with Turn Off the Lights.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Clemency Burtonhill, and Tom Edwards. That was, of course, Nelly Furtado with Turn Off the Lights. Time now to leaf through today's Canadian front pages with our very own managing editor, David Michon. So nice to see you.
Hello, the both of you.
Hi, David.
You've been working extremely hard this morning because, David, you also produced The Globalist.
Yes, we're keeping the team very tight this morning.
We're keeping it tight.
It's just I like that. To see this. Yeah. Occasional flurry of activity from you.
Yes, you know, everyone has to put in their time at 4 in the morning, you know, at some point.
Absolutely.
Today was my day.
Carly Rae.
Carly Rae
Jepsen. Does she have to put in her time at 4 a.m.?
I don't know, probably. She's on the front page
Maybe.
Of almost every Canadian paper, not the Globe and Mail. Of course, yesterday was the Juno Awards, which is Canada's major music awards. And actually, Nelly Furtado, who we just heard, once hosted the ceremony. So, you know, of course, what's interesting about Carly Rae's win is that it comes at the expense, in a few cases, of Justin Bieber, another major Canadian pop icon who actually discovered Carly Rae Jepsen.
Justin who?
Justin what? What? Yeah, Bieber. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he's a massive, massive star, and he's Canadian.
You guys, pumping them out.
Exactly. We just produce.
Are you proud of this fact, do you think?
Well, you know, I was saying to you earlier, we have all of these pop stars, but people so rarely recognize them as Canadian. I think people just assume that they're, you know, from the United States. But in fact, you know.
So this is Canada's time.
It is Canada's
time.
Taken
over the musical universe.
We have a long history of successful pop musicians. Celine Dion, anyone?
A few legends. I wonder, has Carly Rae, she ever upset anyone at any kind of, you know, significant Holocaust museum? Or does she leave that to just to Justin?
No, yeah, that's Justin's territory, unfortunately. You know,
so
she
far.
Has to, you know, he's a bit of a mentor for her, so she doesn't want to step on his, you know, on his realm.
That's true. Probably leave that alone.
I think she's doing enough offensive things with her music. Some might say.
You better watch out. Call Me Maybe is one of our culture editor Rob Bowne's favorite songs. But it's proved for a few kind of interesting headlines. Most notably, Call Me a Juno winner, maybe not. Call Me Maybe definitely wins. So it's been...
It's clever. It's
Call
a
Me
dream.
A Juno winner, it's a, not maybe. And people are really thinking outside the box.
It's a very good time for the Canadian sub-editor.
Is anyone interested in anything else this morning?
Yes. Well, there is obviously a few stories about the Boston Marathon or the London Marathon, and with references to the Boston Marathon, and of course what's going on with the suspect that's in custody. On the Montreal Gazette, actually, one of their lead stories is a photo of the Mount Royal Memorial run, which was kind of a low organized. Run that happened in Montreal on Sunday to honor the Boston Marathon and the victims of that event. So that was, I think, organized via Twitter and Facebook and got about 1,000 people in the city to kind of run around one of its main parks.
I'm looking at a story on the Toronto Star front page. In fact, the lead story, a Star investigation, City blew $500,000 on sanitizer. Sanitizer.
Mm-hmm. My eye was drawn to this as well. I don't know why.
It's just such an unfeasible amount of money for a stockpile of hand sanitizer.
It's a lot of hand sanitizer. But, you know, SARS obviously hit Toronto, several years ago. And so I think the city was obviously very paranoid about the potential of there being another outbreak. And so this is, you know, this was a stockpile of supplies, part of a stockpile of supplies that was meant to kind of help the city combat, those types of contagious diseases should they break out. But I guess...
And what is particularly depressing...
I mean, we're lucky that we didn't need to use this hand sanitizer, really.
Right, and it did cost $53,750 to throw it out as well. I mean, that's sort of... But what could they not... I mean, does it go off? It's just alcohol, isn't it? Surely they couldn't just keep it as a stockpile for the next time. You know, let's hope this never happens.
Maybe this is an issue of the hand sanitizer producers, that they've kind of maybe... Flooded the market.
It's a good
opportunity. Slapped an expiry date on it and have had to replace the supplies.
Some more good puns, though. Emily Matthew in this piece. The City of Toronto flushed $500,000 of hand sanitizer down the drain. It's rich in puns today. Which I'm a big fan of.
You know.
Anything else catching your eye, David?
Yeah, there's a small story here about... the major US retailer Target has just moved into Canada, opening a shop in Toronto recently. And they're set to take over a portion of Zellers, which is a Canadian retailer that has gone under. So Walmart taking over some of their stores and Target taking over the others. And they've been told by the federal government that they have to include some Canadian content in their shops. I think they refer to it as uniquely Canadian cultural products. I mean, I don't know what that is other than maple syrup and things that say Canada on them. But there is a bit of a race amongst kind of Canadian producers to kind of get into Target. So, and you know, people who are kind of producing clothes or jewelry or various other products and now see an opportunity to get themselves into a major retailer. So that's, I suppose, exciting for some entrepreneurs in Canada who have a new market for themselves there.
You mentioned that the Globe and Mail were not leading on Carly May. They have an interesting story about Obama okaying a pipeline. Tell us more very briefly about that.
Yes. So, I mean, there is a... sorry. One second.
The Keystone XL pipeline.
Yeah. I just wonder, is that a real problem in Canada? Because there's a great deal of controversy about, you know, pipelines and where they go. Is there a feeling that some people are getting rich off them and other people are missing out?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, obviously
we should clarify, this is going from Alberta direct to American refineries.
Yes. So there is obviously a lot of oil in Alberta. Our Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, is from Alberta, so obviously has those interests in mind. So there is kind of, a diverse opinion, and a lot of people think that, you know, we should be, maybe not building pipelines across the country.
Maybe it's as divisive as Carly Rae or whatever.
Versus Bieber.
Exactly. The big questions here at Monica 24. That's all we have time for, I'm afraid. Our thanks today to our producer, Dawn Trump, our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and James Bullock, and our studio manager, Alex Funnell.
Up next off the news is The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. This week we look into whether Vienna is ready for a musical rebrand and if one of Sydney's city centre music festivals makes a good neighbour. Dom Reynolds and Phil Han will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, but from me, Clemency Burton Hill.
And from me, Tom Edwards, goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.